These were the ways of 16th century diplomacy to which Machiavelli gave his dubious inspiration and his notorious name. The sly and crafty prince conjured up by him in 1513 stalked through the unprincipled decades that followed, bending diplomacy to cunning and confusing cunning with statecraft. The Europe of the time, of course, with its power patchwork of feudal intricacies, was ideally suited to this view of my profession. This warrior or military view, as my friend Sir Harold Nicholson has called it.
Fundamental to such a conception of diplomacy is the belief that the purpose of negotiation is victory, and the denial of complete victory means defeat. In this view, well, diplomacy is regarded as an unremitting activity directed towards ultimate triumph.
This warrior view of diplomacy, of course, came quite naturally to emperors, kings, and princes. And since men and countries were regarded as being the absolute property of the ruling monarchs, I and my colleagues inevitably found that diplomacy became a problem of personalities and of intimacy. We could not be too squeamish about lying, spying, or stealing either documents or affections. And I, the diplomat, was no longer very young. Still, my country needed my services, and duty was duty.
Come in.
Ah, madame, I regret I'm a little late. Please accept my apologies and my compliments.
You appear out of breath, Your Excellency.
Well, the climb up the stairs has, I'm afraid, been somewhat taxing upon my heart, madame.
Oh? Oh, yes, of course. Sit beside me. Here, and let your heart recover. Sit, I beg of you. Over here by me.
Thank you, madame. The king's favorite is renowned for her youth and her incomparable beauty. But I now discover that her kindness is also without limit.
But unfortunately, my time is not, Your Excellency. The king returns at nightfall, and so shall we get to the point of your visit?
I must say, madame, that for those of us who must pursue my profession, it is indeed refreshing to deal with one so understanding and so forthright. It makes matters so much easier.
Oh.
I have reason to believe, madame, that the king received a communication last night, which I would...
Which you would like to see?
Madame is so perceptive. But my needs are not exorbitant. Perhaps if madame could just arrange for me casually to glance through the document.
The king, Your Excellency, guards his secrets well.
I am sure he has no secrets from you.
His Majesty is indeed generous, but unhappily there are some small matters that I am forced to keep from him. Some small secrets that I may share only with you.
You flatter me, madame, if only my years permitted.
Your years sit upon you well, Your Excellency. Tell me, do you like this necklace?
It is as luminous as the throat it adorns.
They say I have extravagant tastes. The jeweler is a Florentine and most gifted, as you can see. But he is so demanding.
I know the man, madame. The fingers of an artist and the soul of...
A diplomat?
It pleases madame to jest.
Oh, I assure you, no. I only pay tribute to a high art which can serve, shall we say, practical ends. Do you gamble, Your Excellency?
Yes, madame, when the stakes are high enough.
At whist?
At anything.
Oh, but you may lose. I've been known to cheat, particularly when the stakes are high.
Madame, only cobblers and coachmen cheat. The beautiful and the diplomatic merely manipulate fate.
You have most endearing ways, Your Excellency. You might even win. Shall we draw the cards?
I am entirely in your hands, madame. The assignation left me weak financially. I was substantially out of pocket, and ambassadorial expenses were not fully reimbursed in those days. But I at least could console myself with the thought that the king's favorite had been charming, although my pocket was lighter. So at least was my heart. But things were about to change. The stream of human events was flowing, and history was carving new channels through the granite of time. As conditions changed, so did the philosophy and practice of diplomacy. The process, of course, was not sudden. It did not happen overnight. It took centuries. New forces were at work, with a new direction. It happened first in North America.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish.
It happened then in France.
Liberté! Égalité! Fraternité!
Government of the people, by the people, and for the people. This also meant diplomacy of the people, by the people, for the people. Democracy dulled the glitter of Machiavellian intrigue. We ambassadors now had to deal not with kings divinely ordained, but with cabinets, replaceable by a vote. With the change of political systems, there had to be a change in diplomatic hearts. A new force had arisen which dragged diplomacy out of the scented boudoirs and the gilded ballrooms right into the open marketplace of public opinion. It stood face to face with the man in the street, and the man in the street had much to do with another important man, the shopkeeper.
Now, trade, Harry, my lad. It's trade, that's what I'm referring to. I'll be with you in just a moment, sir. As I was saying, I know what I know. And that is that this country has got to have trade, and then more trade, and after that, still more trade. If all these lords, high and mighty, with their wigs and their silks and their minuets, were to pay more mind to commerce than to having fun, we'd all be a lot better off. Believe me, Harry, my boy, I know what
I'm talking about. The Crusades, the Venetian monopoly, the fall of the Eastern Empire, the formation of the Hanseatic League, all these had exercised their influence upon the expanding mercantile traffic.
Then had come the great voyages. Voyages which carried men beyond the blue horizon of the known world, across new frontiers of economic interest, and the political understanding that came with it. This was the other important force which shaped my destiny as a diplomat. Power politics gradually, but necessarily, gave place to profit politics, and to what my friend Sir Harold has called the shopkeeper view of diplomacy.
The commercial, the mercantile, or the shopkeeper conception of diplomacy is based on the assumption that a compromise between rivalries is generally more profitable than the complete destruction of the rival. That negotiation is not a mere phase in a death struggle, but an attempt by mutual concession to reach some durable understanding.
Confidence, human reason, fair dealing, and the placing of cards on the table. This was the demand of the middle classes, the demand for the middle point of conciliation. And this demand gave my career an historic turn. It led me to the conference table. Through the centuries, the commercial urge to the conference table continued to develop. But also at work was another important force, a force destined to make the table larger and larger still. This force was born of war. Each call to arms led to a call to conference. And as each war became bigger, so did the conference table. The 30-year war of religions.
The Congress of Westphalia, 1648.
The wars of Napoleon.
The Congress of Vienna, 1815.
The world war which men called the first.
The League of Nations, 1920.
The world war which was the second and must be the last.
The peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women and of nations, large and small, and to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom, have resolved to combine our efforts to accomplish these aims.
So here I am today, a diplomat at the United Nations. What is my job? International diplomacy. The universal diplomacy which today is the only alternative to universal extinction. My method? The conference table. The table which today reaches right round the world. And so my days unroll, taking me from country to country and problem to problem. Yes?
We have your reservation, flight 901 for Geneva, leaving at 2 p.m. tomorrow, sir.
Thank you. To Geneva for the conference on the abolition of slavery.
लो सर पहुंच गए We have arrived, sir, at the WHO regional headquarters.
In New Delhi, to confer on malaria control in Southeast Asia.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Cairo. Please keep your seats until the health authorities have boarded the plane.
Technical assistance conference on arid zones and desert reclamation.
Paris, Gare Saint-Lazare, dans trois minutes, messieurs, dames.
The Secretary General's Advisory Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy. And, of course, I am always on call at United Nations headquarters in New York.
Attention, may I have your attention, please? Correspondents are informed that a meeting of the Security Council on the Palestine question has been called for tomorrow, 10:30 a.m. That is all.
So there you are. I am an international diplomat at the United Nations. I am to be found here whenever men need me, and they need me today for many things in many places. It may be that there's been some trouble somewhere, a sickness, a disaster, an argument, or perhaps even a full-scale war. Here, the call may be for insulin, there for independence. Here, help is sought on economic development. There, the claim is pressed for human rights. Here, the call is for skills to stop a flood, and there, the request is for armies to stop an aggression. So you see, I've come a long way from my bilateral mission of Neanderthal days. I've travelled far through the dark caverns of time to the expansive horizons of universality. Universality of interest and of effort. What qualities am I required to possess today?
What about my view that a diplomat's job is to gather secret information, be alert and cunning, steal relatives and gems, generally sow dissension?
Cheri Cortelia, your views, sir, were most Machiavellian, but I'm afraid that...
Did someone mention my name, Machiavelli?
Oh, Niccolo. My dear friend, I was only referring to the somewhat shady political philosophy to which you gave your name.
You call it... shady?
I don't mind telling you, and Cheri Cortelia here also, that you gentlemen made me suffer much in my career.
What did we do?
Both you gentlemen combined in the East and the West to give my profession a most dubious reputation.
We were only trying to help you.
I appreciate that, but fortunately for all of us, your views are no longer relevant. Times have changed. Today, I find the advice I get from the United Nations Secretary General, Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld, infinitely more useful in the performance of my duties. Sir, Mr. Hammarskjöld?
There is a widespread view that diplomacy is a game where it pays to be shrewd, where moral laws are somehow suspended, and where it is laudable to fool your adversary. Need I tell you that such a view is wrong? Diplomacy of this kind may yield temporary and limited successes, but it will never lay the foundation for lasting agreements or understanding. The highest qualities in politics and diplomacy are the highest qualities also in common life.
Thank you, Mr. Hammarskjöld. Well, I think that settles it, my friends, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
The point is that the conditions of modern life make diplomatic integrity essential. Double dealing is unprofitable. 19th century steam shrank the world and made the nations neighbors by necessity. Today, the 20th century atom has imposed a life or death partnership upon us all. That is why negotiation, conciliation, and honest compromise have become synonyms for continued existence.
But tell me, how is it possible to conduct negotiations, as I believe you gentlemen do, within earshot of the whole world? This open diplomacy of yours. Can you really bargain out in the open with the whole world listening in on, I believe you call it, the wireless?
As a matter of fact, you're somewhat out of date, Cheri Cortelia. We now not only practice our craft within earshot of the world, but under its very nose, eyes, to be more precise. Our conferences nowadays are not only broadcast, but televised.
You mean you are actually watched while at work? By everybody? I should have found that most unnerving.
The experience, Signor Machiavelli, is not without its points of interest. A famous colleague of mine, Mr. Lester B. Pearson, Canadian Secretary of State for External Affairs, recently amused himself with some thoughts on the subject.
It is interesting to speculate on the effect of broadcasting and television on international conferences such as the United Nations Assembly. That effect seems to me to be fourfold. First, it keeps the delegates awake and forces them to look interested in what is going on. Secondly, it requires that they should be very careful about their doodling, now that we have those special television cameras that pick you up in detail at long range without the victim knowing anything about it. Thirdly, television has caused a noticeable sartorial improvement among the delegates in their grooming and in their general appearance. I'm told that it even improved mine. And finally, these new publicity devices have helped to popularize, and at times even, I suppose, to vulgarize, the language and the methods of diplomacy. In earlier times, in those days of Cotilla and Machiavelli, diplomats were limited to mild and polite expressions such as distaste or deprecate. They regretted, or they had the honor to differ. They made démarche, and they brought about détente. But those were the spacious, well-mannered, and easy-going days of diplomacy. We are at least franker now. Frank at times to the point of ferocity.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson.
Frankness? Ferocity? Surely that's an exaggeration.
Judge for yourself. I'll have the radio play back to you a few samples from public meetings in the not-too-distant past.
Distortions, slanders, libels.
A complete travesty of the facts. Effrontery, innocent, sweet-sounding propaganda maneuver.
The yoke of Soviet domination.
Bare-faced capitalist calumny.
Upside-down language.
A poor babble.
A pack of lies. What lies? What lies?
Enough, what lies? Enough. Dio mio, what language.
What
turn
lies?
That thing off.
What lies? What lies?
Phew, that certainly was hard on the nerves.
I'm sorry to have exposed you to this, gentlemen, but in all fairness, I had to admit to this aspect of open diplomacy. Frequently, we have tended to talk at instead of to each other for its histrionic effect upon the gallery.
That is exactly my point. It is for this reason that I always favored quiet diplomacy, behind closed doors and away from the public glare.
I think, Sri Cordelia, that Mr. Hammarskjöld can set your mind at rest on that score also. He finds that we can make use today of both quiet as well as open diplomacy. Both have virtues, as he says.
It is my feeling that there is now a broader recognition than before of the value of quiet diplomacy within the framework of the organization as a complement to the conference diplomacy of the public debates. My belief is that a further development in that direction is warranted and would in no way reduce the value of conference diplomacy.
Thank you, Mr. Hermerschold. Satisfied, gentlemen?
Yes, thank you. I am grateful for your patient explanation of your modern needs and ways.
Permit us now to withdraw. Our time has run out. Come, Cotilia.
Farewell, gentlemen.
Farewell.
Farewell.
Farewell. Farewell.
Ladies and gentlemen, the time for farewells has arrived. I, the diplomat, must also leave you now. I have spun before you the story of my historic years. I have tried to show you how man's advancing centuries have pressed me from the narrow valleys of tribal, limited interest to the broad uplands of universality, from which all horizons are clearly seen. As I have travelled up the slopes of time, so have others in other lands, climbing from the tribal, beyond the merely national, to the truly international. I have lived before you our yesterdays and our todays. In them also beats the pulse of our unborn tomorrows. Time past is time present. Time present is future's time. So I leave you with the future and with a final thought from Secretary General Hammarskjöld, a thought to which some 80 nations of the world subscribe their emphatic yes.
Afghanistan, Argentina, Australia, Belgium, Bolivia, Brazil.
The United Nations, the organization, is imperfect. It can be improved. But the concept of a world community of United Nations, the vision, the goal of our long journey from barbarism to civilization, is now a part of our lives. Let us make use of the United Nations, or this instrument we have created. Move further towards cooperation among nations in strengthening peace and in helping our fellow men throughout the world to build a fuller, a more abundant life for all.
Turkey?
Yes.
South Africa?
Yes.
Soviet Union?
There.
United Kingdom?
Yes.
The United States?
Yes.
Uruguay?
Si.
Venezuela?
Si.
Yemen?
Yes.
You have been listening to I, the Diplomat, a United Nations radio production commemorating the 11th anniversary of the United Nations, with the actual voices of Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld and Mr. Lester B. Pearson, especially recorded for this program.
I, the Diplomat,
was played by Michael Redgrave.
The Duke.
Basil Rathbone.
The Minister for the Barbarians.
Edward Everett Horton.
The Emperor.
Aye.
Abraham Sofair.
The Declaration of Independence.
Albert Decker.
Preamble to the United Nations Charter.
Orson Welles.
The King's Favorite.
Julianne Marie.
The Slave Trader from Byzantium. And Niccolo Machiavelli, and
all played by John Draney. Gesundheit.
Script.
Written by Gole O'Bry and Gerald Keane.
Music.
Composed and conducted by Louis Applebaum.
Special effects.
Harold Johnson.
Production and direction.
Gerald Keane of United Nations Radio. I, the Diplomat, is a transcribed feature presentation of ABC Radio.